Okay, well, thank you for joining me. We have Shirley Zimmon, Carpal Zimmon, and Sam Stewart here with us today. And Carpal, would you mind telling us where we're at today?
We are in my daughter's house in Anchorage, Alaska.
Perfect. And can you state your name?
My name is Carpal Zimmon Jr.
Can you spell that for us so we make sure we get it correct?
CARVELZIMINJR, of course.
Perfect. And Shirley, would you mind introducing yourself?
I'm Shirley Grindle, married to Carpal Zimmon Jr.
And correct spelling of your name?
SHIRLEYZIMIN.
Perfect. And Grindle?
Grindle's my maiden name. GRINDLE.
Perfect. And Sam?
Samuel Carpal Stewart.
Can you spell that for us?
SAMUELSTEWERT.
Perfect. Okay. Well, thank you again for inviting me into your home today to do this interview. This is very important. You guys are a very important part of this story, and for particularly telling the local story. And you guys have been the caretakers of this history. So it's very important that we capture we're going to be talking probably about four generations today of stewardship of the cannery. So Carpal, if you wouldn't mind, if you can tell us who you are and how long, and your relation, talk a little bit about your relationship to South Naknek.
I'm Carpal Zimmon Jr. and my father Carpal Zimmon was a winter watchman. My older brother Clyde Zimmon was winter watchman, and my grandfather Nick Zimmon was the first winter watchman of the Zimmon clan.
And how did Nick Zimmon's connection with the South Naknek cannery begin?
Nick Zimmon was traveling from Hawaii over to the West Coast and was looking for employment, and found his way up to Seattle, where he was able to get a job with Alaska Packers Association, jumped on a ship, and went to Bristol Bay and South Naknek, particularly at this cannery in 1927.
How did he become the winter watchman?
He was working right after he got off the ship. I guess they figured that he was such a dependable, good worker. They needed somebody to fill in after somebody was retiring, and they picked my grandfather Nick to do that. So he got that job that way. He was a dependable worker.
He started at Diamond M.
So.
Diamond O?
No, NN.
Okay.
And Shirley, can you talk to us about how your relationship is, how it began in South Naknek?
I grew up in South Naknek. My father worked for Alaska Packers as a machinist. And I got out of high school and I got my first job right out of day after graduation. I was a waitress in the mess hall. Then I later moved to laundry.
So what are the beginning roots of your family there in South Naknek?
My mother is a descendant of the old Katmai, and they later moved to New Sevenoski, and then later moved to South Naknek. And then I just grew up, and later on, just Junior and I got together. So, my dad and Carpal Sr. were best friends. And they worked together, and they helped each other all the time. And Dad needed something, Carpal would help him, and they just took turns. And we've been there since, I was born in Igigik, and then we moved to South Naknek in 62. And then that's when my dad started working for the cannery.
Okay. Carpal, can you talk about your mother and her family? I know you talked about your father.
My mother is Annie Zimmon. She been living in South Nakhning most all of her life. I think she was born at Reindeer Station when she was younger, and ended up moving to South Nakhning when she was pretty young, and pretty much lived there all her life. Met my father, Carvel Zimmern, and got married, and all of us kids came along.
And can you talk about any stories about the eruption in the beginning of South Nakhning?
I heard stories that after the 1919 eruption, they had to move away from Old Sevenoski, and that the amount of ash that was in the area was, you know, anywhere from 4 inches to 10 inches or more. It covered everything up near where the mountain was, and even all the way down into towards South Nakhning. But that's why they had to move away from the eruption, is because of the amount of ash. And they formed New Sevenoski. I know that Shirdi's family also was there. My family, my mom's side, was growing up in a reindeer herd situation, and she was traveling around in different places. One of the places she was born was at Reindeer Station, and so they were kind of nomadic somewhat, but their main base was around South Nakhning. So most of the residents of New Sevenoski, Old Sevenoski, and other places migrated to South Nakhning because of the Alaska Packers Association cannery there that started in, I think, 1892, and eventually about 1900 it was starting to flourish, and a lot of employment from the for the area was coming from Alaska Packers, and it created a lot of opportunity for residents like the native village of New Sevenoski and other places to get employment. So with the cannery being located in South Nakhning, that's what started the village of South Nakhning.
Can you talk about that transition to becoming employees of the cannery?
Well, the transition really for my Zimmern side of the family began with my grandfather Nick, of course, in 1927. So it would have been, you know, a good 8 or 9 years after the eruption, you know. And at some point he met my grandmother Mary, and married and had a couple of kids, which is my dad and my aunt and my uncle who had passed away. But that was their connection for the Zimmern side of the family. My mom Annie Zimmern was always living in South Nakhning, and when she married my dad, they of course had a house and started working for Alaska Packers Association in different places. At the beginning, my father worked for Bumblebee Seafoods, and when an opening showed up, they wanted him to become winter watchman at Alaska Packers Association at the South Nakhning plant. So there was wherever you end up is wherever employment is, I think. And that's really how he got started there. So when my grandpa Nick had his job in 1927, I'm not sure how many years he went, a good amount of years before he retired. He had a house right on the edge of South Nakhning that he owned himself, he built himself. And that was the house that they also used as a winter watchman's house, because he was so close. I mean, That was another reason why he was a winter watchman there, is that, or after he got the job, he built a house real close to the cannery. So,
rolling back to 1919, do you have any stories that you can share about the Spanish influenza epidemic?
We heard a lot of stories of the people who got sick and was just passing away. It was quite devastating. As I grew up, I remember seeing a huge cross in New Semenoski, and so it was twice or three times as big as all the other ones. And, you know, and then we had the stories that go along with it. They said there was 99 people who died from the influenza, and that they were dropping so fast that they had dug one hole and then buried 99 people in one grave. And that was the significance of the big cross that was there. Other significant parts of my family with the flu was that my grandmother Mary, who ended up marrying Nick Zimmern, was actually an orphan. Her parents had passed away from the flu and left the three girls, which is Nina, Mary, and then Anna. And they were in the orphanage over in Dillingham. And after the influenza hit, that's where they were taken to. And the tie into that was that Nina Harris, the oldest sister,
got picked
to be a wife of Fred Crown. And she, one of her stipulations was she would marry him if she was able to bring along her sisters and a few other people. And so he agreed to that. And after he brought his new wife over to, I think, Libbyville, he brought Mary Zimmern and Anna. And in that group, I know, was a guy named Carl Yalek, who interestingly ended up becoming my grandfather on my mom's side. So there was like a little entourage of people that came from the orphanage that came along with the marriage to Fred Crown. So.
Do you have any stories about how the influenza began, the big sickness began?
I'm not sure if I remember any stories of this, them telling us how it began.
I thought it was the ship.
Yeah, there was people that came in for the cannery and probably in the spring of 1919 that spread the flu, because I don't think there was much going on before that. Everybody was healthy. There was as many as, I think, 800 people who lived in New Semenoski at one point. There was a lot of people there and devastated the place. I mean, there was hardly anybody after the flu was there. So killed just about most all the village. And I know there was quarantines and people said, well, you can't come here and stuff like that, that mom and dad had talked about. So there were stories about that.
So after the devastation of the influenza, you talked about children being sent to the orphanage. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Just the story that I already told you, okay. That's all I remember them talking to us about, was that that's where Grandma Mary and her Aunt Nina and our Aunt Anna came from. And Carl Yalek, of course. That was interesting. I think there was others that...
My Grandma Fiona, too.
Your Grandma Fiona and Linda's Wasley's parents.
Oh, Linda Crown?
Yeah.
Elena.
Yeah.
Her mom, Elena.
Right. So there was
she died in 1919.
There was a lot of people who lived in South Acton who came along with that group. And so that was fairly interesting.
Nina was sick, but she recovered.
Yeah, she was the oldest. I imagine she was 10 or 12 years old.
Yeah, she recovered.
Maybe a little longer. Maybe older than that, even 14 or 16. Mm-hmm. So...
Do you have any stories about the crash of the salmon fishing after the influenza?
Not much. I'm sorry. I know that as I grew up, there was a crash back in the 60s, but I don't remember too many stories about the crash after 1919. I know that the salmon was cyclic, and I've seen a few of the records of production from Alaska Packers Association. They have it in their archives, but I never heard stories related to why that might have been.
And we talked about Annie living in New Savanoski, correct?
She did we not? No, she never really lived there. She was, like I said, in the reindeer station, and
her grandpa raised her.
That's right. Okay.
And so then this isn't reindeer station where she was born was actually near King Salmon.
Gotcha.
And
my grandma's
from it was also a fish camp too. So
she never lived in Savanoski.
Yeah, and after Evdokia, her mom moved to South Naknekat after she had married Carl Yalik, had my mother Annie
Zimmern. Then she moved her second marriage to.
Well, yeah, but before that, of course, Carl passed away from drowning up at PAF, and so mom was not even born yet.
Mm-mm.
She was like 8 or 9 months pregnant when they lost Carl
Yalik. 2 weeks.
How many? 2 weeks?
He drowned 2 weeks before she was born.
Yeah, so almost full term, and then the guy passed away, Carl Yalik did, and then she married Andrew and Tegnak, and that's where my relatives are from, the Holstroms and Tegnak side of the family.
So can you tell me your job at the NN, or at the cannery?
I'm the winter watchman and caretaker during the winter, but during the summertime I also do a lot of supervisory role. So I guess I'm the main person there, making sure that everybody continues to work during the summertime under my employment, and then during the wintertime we are able to maintain all the buildings so that they're there and everything is going to be ready for the next season.
How did you get this job?
My older brother had the job for 17 years, maybe 20 years. And I think 17 years. And he decided to move out to Wasilla, so we were picked to be the next watchman. I'd already been a supervisor at Diamond O for pulling barges in and out and working in the spring fall crew and the beach gang and stuff, so it was a transition, or an easy transition, to pick me, and we just moved into the house at Clyde.
Because we knew the history and what to be done.
Yeah, it was, we're all kind of, one of the things about South Naknek, which is kind of fun is, and good to work with, is most everybody in the group work together as a team. So that it probably made it a lot easier for transition. I know even back when my father was a winter watchman there for many years, her dad was in the pork chop. And so everybody worked together to do whatever task at hand was to be performed. So it felt like you were working as a team the whole time I grew up. It was really easy. You have a lot of people that are able to help out on our crew, so they're really appreciative of a lot of Fred Crown Jr. is a cousin of mine, just about the same age, and so he grew up doing the same thing on the beach gang. Of course, we'd all run off and go fishing in the summertime, and that was kind of the fun part, but then we'd have to go back to work in the fall time, so we were all spring and fall crew. So.
Can you talk about who else works on that crew and the other jobs, and a little bit more about how, like, the actual day-to-day work that you guys did in the spring fall crew?
Oh, well, spring fall crew, of course, there was, you know, a lot of my good friends. What we were responsible for doing is to open up the buildings, make sure that there's heat and water, make sure the pipes are going, everything that you have to do to make the house livable if it was repairing doors or windows or whatever. We were kind of jack of all trades, so we had everything going for the summer crew that was supposed to show up. And my brother and both my brothers worked at South Naknek's, cousins, lots of cousins, Walter.
I worked there.
Friends, Bruce Anderson, Shirley's.
Locals, a lot of locals.
All the locals that seemed to be a perfect fit for a spring fall crew because you already lived there. And you had a place to stay and a place to eat. You didn't have to open up a building. So it was always a pretty easy transition for people living outside to come walk, you know, get off the plane, go right to their building, and everything was ready to go, getting ready for summer. So.
What do you think the value of the spring fall crew is?
I thought it was pretty high. Nothing would happen without us. And I know that we were a part of a team. I think this is something that had to happen before something else had to happen. And so we were one, lucky to get employment, two, you know, got paid to do it, and we're working with good friends. And even the summer people, a lot of the summer people are all really good friends, or still are today. So, well, it was always just something we did, I guess. I don't know. It was fun to do the spring fall crew, getting everything going in the springtime, and then transitioning it off to people who got off the plane, and making sure they did their job, so that we can just go hang nets and jump on a boat, go fishing, and then we'd fish all summer long, and then we'd come back at the end of fishing when it slowed down a little bit, and we'd jump right back into work, and that transition us to take over, and then they'd get on the plane and leave. And then we'd just go and winterize buildings and get everything set before winter set in, so that nothing freezes or breaks, or everything would be ready for the next year. So it was a continuous getting ready for the next thing, if you want to put it that way.
Do you remember what the first year is that you worked on the spring fall crew?
1976.
High school.
Yeah, I was still in high school. And 75 or 76.
We used to get the White House ready, iron all those curtains.
Yeah. We all started everything a little younger. Everything
was set perfect.
Yeah, we all started a little younger than you're supposed to. I think we were supposed to work till 18, but we ended up having to work because our dads were there, and we knew that nobody was, you know, everything was going to go great. We all worked as a team still. But it was kind of fun, where I remember working during the day. Because, of course, my senior year, I only had to go half the year, you know. And so the other half the year, when I got off the plane in South Naknek after school was over, was to go down and go to work on the beach gang. And one day we were supposed to graduate, and I was driving forklift on the beach gang, and I drove off the plank on the wooden plank, got the forklift stuck, and I had to run because I had to go to my graduation, and I had to leave my friends to pull my forklift out. So that was kind of interesting and different, I guess. So.
How old were you when that happened?
Oh, that was probably when I was a senior.
77 you graduated.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did 78.
Yeah, I was 18. 17, actually, when that happened.
Do you have any other favorite stories about those years working on the beach gang?
A lot of good friends. I think, like I said, there, you know, everybody, all the local people were friends and related, but, you know, there was a lot of outside people that were good friends on the beach gang. And you'd have Norwegians and Swedes, and
they'd bring us gifts.
There'd be Italians, and there'd be all kinds of ethnic groups, but they're all, I mean, we were all able to talk and joke and have fun and play games and, you know, all kinds of neat things together. So I guess growing up there, one of the things I thought I took for granted was that so many different ethnic groups were represented, and they were just all friends. So, I mean, the Norwegian guy, he loved to play soccer, and he'd talk like Norwegian and stuff, and the Swede guy would be the same thing, and it was always kind of cool. Yeah. Some of the other stories, I guess, I don't know. When I was working with on the Beach King with Bill Brown's dad, Grant Brown, who was a winter watchman before my dad, he was always such a gruff old man, and you know, he'd have a big loud voice, and anything he said, and you kind of jumped. But you know, I knew him as a friend also, so it wasn't so bad. But he was actually pretty interesting to have to work for. And one of the times that one of the jobs we had was to pull up some of the planks off the decking, and in order to do that, Brownie decided that he would use a pile driver, which is a great big device that had a big long cable on it. We put a hook on it, and he'd run the pile driver and pull the planks up. And that was one way of replacing the decking on the deck. And I was driving the forklift. After he pulled up a plank, I'd grab a hold of it, the forklift, and drag it off. And one time he was pulling some of the planks up, and then Per was, like I said, the Norwegian guy. He'd run around, and after they pulled the plank up, he'd try to grab it, put it down again so that I could take it away. So it was always pretty dangerous. You had hooks flying all over the place. And over the top of the winch house, Brownie had a canvas house, so that when it was raining out, it wouldn't rain on the brakes. And I guess I must have been a little bit slow getting my forklift, and Brownie would yell at me, "Get over there and get that plank." And so I was always aware of it. And they pulled up a plank, and Pear went and grabbed it and put it down, and I ran over with the forklift, and I started pulling it backwards, and Brownie was standing inside the canvas house, and he didn't realize that one of the planks was hanging up on the canvas. And so I stopped, and Brownie came out, and he started yelling at me, "I said to pull that thing out of there." And so I said, "Okay." So I backed off, and I pulled the whole house down. He was standing there with his hands in the air, and he looked around, he smiled, he says, "I said go." And so that was kind of a funny little story. We always had that, you always had big projects. It seemed like, you know, you're always changing deck, or you're always driving piling. And then doing caps and doing a lot of hard, heavy work. And being able to do that was always kind of fun. You knew that you felt accomplished when you were done, when you got a project done. So it was kind of fun.
And can you talk about why that hard, heavy kind of work was so important for the cannery?
It was busy. Lots of people.
Yeah, everybody had to have everything ready for when the salmon hit. I mean, when the salmon started showing up, you had to be ready to process them. You had to have good planks, you had to have decking, you had to have, you were having tenders come by with loads of fish, so everything had to work in sync with the salmon run, and you never really knew when the salmon were going to show up. So you had to be ready ahead of time and ready for anything, and you didn't want to have any downtime trying to fix something. Because the more you had salmon processing, the more money the cannery made. And so I guess it was pride in your work too, I think.
Well, and I know from living there myself that a lot of this is that it takes on such an importance because the season is so short.
Yeah.
And so I can only imagine that having that local knowledge to be able to see the storm damage throughout the winter, mm-hmm. to anticipate that's part of what gives you the ability to do your job that much better and to work really closely on that team.
Yeah. No, I agree. if you were there and you knew what had to be fixed before the summer started, then you were ready to go. So it didn't matter if there was big ice chunks coming down the middle of the river and breaking, piling off during the winter, then you knew it next spring, as soon as ground thawed, you were ready to go and fix it. And then you knew, had it all lined out, where you're going to get the piling, where you're going to get the wood, where you're going to get the nails, make sure everything is all set to go. And as soon as the weather allowed, that's what you did.
Right. And in order to even do that maintenance, you have to have all those materials on hand. Can you talk about that?
We always had a lot of supply. You had to have everything pretty much there in South Nakhon, because you can't just go down to the Ace Hardware store, or you can't just go over to the lumber place. You had to have all your lumber there. And you had to have all your stock room and all your parts and all your carpenter shops and all your nails and all your everything there on hand for whenever something broke down, in order to be able to fix it. So no doubt, when in the spring, one of the big things that we did was we received the spring barge, and it had a lot of supplies. I mean, it would be a barge completely full of supplies for all the different departments that were available to get supplies. You stocked up. The cannery was almost like self-sufficient, and so you had to have all of the everything you needed for whatever might pop up. So, hi.
We have someone joined the group. Can you introduce yourself?
My name is Liam.
Hi, Liam. Can you spell your name for us?
It's L-I-A-M.
Okay, well, I brought a sticker for you from the project. Thank you for joining us. So on self-sufficiency, can you talk about everything that the cannery would provide that made that self-sufficiency possible?
Well, it was like a village, I guess. You had to have your laundry. You had to have your laundry personnel and all, whatever it takes for making sure that was department was running smoothly. You had your mess hall. You had all your groceries, frozen or non-frozen. You had your cooks. You had your carpenter shop. You had carpenter, woodworkers.
Bull cooks
in the mess hall. You had everything. Everything to keep everybody going for the summer. Self-sufficient, I guess. You had mechanics in the pork shop, like her dad was.
Because if I worked my full 11 hours, they need extra help in the canning warehouse. I was down there till midnight, 1 o'clock.
Oh, yeah. So it was, you had pretty much a standard of 11 hours a day, 7 days a week. But most of the time, it was more than that, because sometimes people needed help in different departments. So it was always kind of whatever it took to get the job done. And they pulled people away from other places. And it made good for good overtime. I mean, we made a lot of money.
Pulling warehouse.
Good overtime, doing whatever we could to make sure that the cannery was able to process and move on to the next thing.
It was a lot of that driven by the teamwork that you talked about, or
absolutely.
Was that something that came from the administration?
No, I think that the administration, Gary Johnson in particular, but all the superintendents knew that they could always count on everybody helping out, no matter where you were at. One time we were out fishing during the middle of the summer, and Gary Johnson decided that his fish cutting crew had been working too many hours, and they were getting pretty tired. And Clyde and I and the partner that we had on our boat just tied up to the dock, and we come up on top of the dock, and Gary says, "Well, hey, can you help us out? Can you go split all these fish here? Give my crew a little bit of a break so they can get a few hours of sleep." So we did. We thought it was kind of fun. We already knew how to split fish. We were tasked with splitting a bunch of king salmon, which we like kings anyway. I mean, we love to catch kings, and these guys know how to split fish too. But yeah, we were asked to split some fish. We were and we felt like we were part of the team again, even though we weren't even on the clock. We were supposed to be out fishing for ourselves, and so Gary, I thought, was pretty cool in asking us to help him process some of the fish so he can get his crew some sleep time.
Can you talk a little bit more about trying to get sleep in
oh my gosh,
a busy Bristol Bay season?
Yeah, it's busy 24 hours a day, pretty much, because the tide goes in, tide goes out twice a day, and when the tide comes in, no matter what, you got fish on the boat, you got to process it in the cannery. So yeah, during the summertime, it's pretty busy. Us fishermen in the boats out there, we had to stay fishing pretty much all the time too, in order to make a living. So everybody, the whole village, the whole cannery, the whole area stayed busy pretty much 24/7 during the summer, because you only had 3 weeks out of the year, maybe, at the very most, and then to process 40 to 60 million fish, that's a task.
So. We got married 40 years ago during the busiest time of the year.
June.
And everyone got from the cannery came to the wedding.
Yeah. It was kind of fun. Like I said, we had friends on.
We still never took a honeymoon.
Yeah.
We're still busy.
We had friends.
Before red season.
Yeah. Like I said, that came off the summer crew, and then, of course, all of us locals. And so it was quite a wedding. There was a lot of people there.
It was a big wedding. So, the whole cannery was there.
Yeah. Those guys and all the locals. So.
We're actually in a book, our wedding.
Mm-hmm. It was kind of fun. Then it was like June 16th. It was just before salmon season. So I don't know who picked that. It wasn't me.
We had to. It's the only time.
Yeah.
Where was your wedding?
South Nagnik, right there. In the little church.
Yeah, right next to the...
Even the mosquitoes were invited.
It was the Russian Orthodox Church right on the boundary of the Alaska Packers Association, the South Nagnik plant. So.
It was good, too, because a lot of the cannery workers never seen a Orthodox wedding.
Yeah.
So it was full.
Yeah. So the cannery, there were probably 400 to 600 people there. And then all the locals, there was a couple, 300 locals.
Yeah. It was like... My dad still is like, my daughter's marrying my best friend's son, so that was cool. Because mm-hmm. His dad and him were best friends.
Are there any other memorable events that you can remember that surround that community of the cannery?
Hmm. We used to have our little dances upstairs in the rec hall. Remember those?
Oh, yeah.
We'd have it end of the season.
End of the season.
We all got dressed up and we didn't recognize nobody. Like,
yeah.
We're all in our work clothes.
So all the cannery workers that wanted to take a break also, they had a company party. Gary Johnson was the one who decided on that. And
we all looked nice.
Maybe all his workers from college wanted to, but it was always kind of fun.
It was fun.
Yeah, with a lot of locals there, a lot of cannery workers there. Other things that we used to love to do too, interaction between the village and the cannery was... We all loved basketball. We had a basketball gym, and the local town folk in high school or outside of high school, you know, were all basketball players and loved to have basketball tournaments. And then when all the cannery workers showed up, there was a good amount of people that were good basketball players. So we'd have the town team of South Nagnik play the cannery. And it was always a good rivalry. I mean, some years that they would be really good with a couple of good players, you know. But most of the time, our local guys would just kick their butt.
They still have the hoop up. The hoop's still up.
Yeah.
Where is the hoop?
By the stock room.
By the stock room. So that's where it would be the cannery workers versus...
Well that
when in on their spare residence. Time, and then they'd go to the gym.
No, actually, we had a gymnasium built there in 1980, I guess. And it was an indoor.
It was my sixth grade when I moved there, so okay. 70s.
70s?
Because I moved in there when I was sixth grade.
Yeah, so there was a basketball court and everything else, so we'd go up there, and that's where we'd have a lot of our intramural basketball games.
In the village there in South Nagnik?
Yeah.
So. Mm-hmm.
They'd also have volleyball tournaments down in the big warehouse. That was kind of fun. They have anywhere from 10 to 12 different teams
I remember pushing
different
those
departments and
mug-up carts. Yeah. You didn't have wheels, four-wheelers then. We had to push those carts.
And that was always right around July 4th because they always, it was like just after the beginning of salmon and just before the big run hit, there was usually a lull where there wasn't much going on or, you know, but there was a lot of cannery workers that had to stay busy.
And then 4th of July, too, I get the kids, and we all get in the wagon with our 4th of Julys, and here I'm pulling them with the laundry lady and the kids, and I have pictures of those.
Yeah, it was always fun. These guys grew up down there, too, and they had a lot of fun watching all the different things happen. So.
We used to have... Gary would have Mother's Day champagne breakfast, drink champagne on the clock, eating breakfast. So that was pretty cool. They would treat mothers, even spixing them, just because, you know, women.
Why do you think he did that?
Because he appreciated women's help, all the help. You know, being a lady is a lot of work. You have a lot, like your grandma, growing up with his grandma, we'd sit down to eat, and she said, we can't eat until the men eat first, and then the ladies and the kids, and I was like, man, this is 2000, I'm going to eat first with the men, you know, but that was her rule, men eat first, and then the ladies and the kids. That's just the way Grandma Mary grew up.
And I can only imagine, as a woman, many of you working were probably also mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got that added responsibility of not just caretaking for all of the other workers that are there. You're still balancing caring for your family.
Gary was so nice. I got to work with my kids, and he'd go fishing. And I had a room in the laundry, and we'd sleep in there.
So your mom?
She grew up in the laundry in Mandy, and later on, I got my hairdresser's license, and I got to open shop in the back and have a laundry work with my kids. So I was amazed. Then I decided, you know, I'm doing really good with this hair job, so I finally quit and opened a business and left the laundry. I was there 17 years, laundry. Well, mess all in the laundry. Yeah, it was fun.
It was a career.
It was a job.
It was a job. You got paid, and it was part of the year, of course. I always had fishing, and then we had that spring and fall income, and then you had spring and fall, but also laundry in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you know.
Because I'd have my spring girls, and then I'd just work by myself with girls that came from Washington. And then when they left, the fall crew girls, with like Denise and Pixie, and they would come help me because they would go fishing. Yep.
One of the things that I should bring up also is when I was their age, I ended up having to stock shelves in the company store. And
how old were you?
Gosh, I probably was.
How old are you, boys? Can you tell us how old you are?
I'm 10.
Liam is 10.
Turning 13.
Yeah.
And Sam is almost 13.
So when I was growing up, about that age, in the cannery house, in the winter house, my dad was a winter watchman at the time. One of the things that they did at the time was they had a company store. Alaska Packers Association had a store. And they would continue to sell goods during the winter to the locals. And in order to do that, even during the summer. But they would sell all the goods that the boats would buy for surviving out in the fishing industry. You had to have groceries to eat. So the groceries and hardware goods and everything, whatever it took to get through the season in the summertime, they also kept on selling during the winter. when all the other people were gone, the locals would continue to go down to buy stuff at the store. Well, my dad was the storekeeper because he was the winter watchman. It came along with the job at the time. And so he employed his kids. He put us to work. We didn't get paid. But, I mean, it was a team again as a family. And I remember my oldest sister, Carol, and Lois, and my older brother, Clyde, and myself, and my younger brother, Carl, all having to go down after school and go after the store was closed and then go stock shelves for the next day. And it was open 7 days a week most of the time during the winter. But one of the things that we learned was, you know, how to stock a shelf. You have to go downstairs and figure out what you needed upstairs, because downstairs was all the storage of the case lots. And then upstairs was all the shelves, and then you'd take all the boxes and carry them up the steps, and then open them up, and then stamp them with a, you have a stamp, price stamper, and then whenever you put everything on the shelf, you put the label out so that people could read it. You know, it was that type of thing. It was just being a storekeeper or somebody working in the store. And it was kind of fun, I guess. Lots of work. It was kind of cool. At one point, my dad decided that he can commandeer a conveyor belt, and so that
that's what he, that is.
Yeah, that conveyor belt. Dad put that in there, and all it does is right next to the steps going down to the lower floor where all the stored goods are, the case lot stuff. You just carry the cases over, put it on a conveyor, hit a lever, and it would go up, and then one of the other kids, you know, the brother or sister, would up there grabbing the cases and then taking them out on the floor. So.
And this is, I think I've seen it. It's in the...
It's where the supplies are.
Supply room, yeah. Where we have the stuff stored for the exhibit right now, right?
Yes,
there's that
exactly.
Conveyor belt that goes up. Okay, yeah. We were looking at that, yeah. And I wondered, but...
No, so, all that whole area downstairs was all storage.
That was the storage.
Yeah, that okay. Was the storage for the store.
And so that conveyor belt came from...
This to cannery somewhere, I'm
one
not
of the
sure.
Cannery lines?
Yeah, one of the can lines.
Wow.
And it became available, and my dad says, hey, I could use that. And to have my kids pack up a case of peaches, you can just put it on a conveyor belt. And so he was always very intuitive, Dad was. He was very innovative.
That's where I got my first bicycle, was a store.
Mm-hmm. They had all kinds of goods. They had clothes.
But then we're all wearing same clothes because we got them from the candy store.
Company clothes, yeah. Yeah, Alaska Packers Association.
White boots
had their own
and
t-shirts. You guys seen the Alaska Packers t-shirts? Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of cool. That's probably why we still do t-shirts.
I have grandpas and juniors in a frame.
I mean, I remember as a kid, it was just something you did every year, was you go to the different stores, and that's what those are, the t-shirts that we wore growing up. You know, I remember, you know, my stolen from Knack Trading Company, and you know, that was your summer shopping.
Do you remember sliding down the hill and not supposed to go down the cannery, but we snuck a couple times?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we did all kinds of fun stuff.
Put your cord up and because that one big beam right there, you'd hit it.
Oh, yeah. Growing up as a kid, and they did the same thing too, is during the wintertime, you'd take sleds and go down the hill. I mean, you found a hill that was full of ice and snow, and that was one of them. It was all cleared away and ready to go.
But ours started from the school and down to the cannery.
Yeah.
So it was like...
The school was on the top of the hill, and you could go all the way from the school down the road to the cannery and then down the cannery.
Oh, we got in trouble, though. We got in trouble. So.
You can imagine you can get hurt, but we never did.
End up in the middle of the river, crying out loud. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of talking a little bit about what I think is a really important thing for people who aren't familiar with our community the way that we are, is the size and the geographic location of our community is part of what dictates the importance of having this cannery store and having the resources that the cannery comes with. Can you talk a little bit more about some of the other resources that the canneries have provided?
Well, one of the things they also did when I was a kid was that they had a hospital a company hospital. Alaska Packers had a doctor, a surgeon, actually come in. They had a medical doctor that was retired, and he would have his own hospital, his own nurse, his own rooms, operating table, x-ray room.
I remember
you guys
that.
Have been over to the hospital. That was, they actually had a doctor and a nurse in there. And when I broke my arm, I went to the doctor and they put it in the cast.
When I was working there, when they closed it, the files were still sitting there. I don't know what happened to those files, but my file was in there. It's like, oh my gosh. I don't know where they went.
Medical files. But yeah, it was, that was one of the things that they did. Of course, growing up there, it was always nice that Dad had the keys to all the places. One of them was the carpenter shop. So anytime I was growing up, if I had to go cut a board or do something, I was able to grab Dad's keys and go down and get some wood or lumber off the rack or plywood or whatever it took and build something, or go to the machine shop and work on, you know, cars or whatever. So you had a lot of resources that were available for us in South Nacogdoches, because there was no place to go.
July of 75, they were still active because my grandpa was flown from Igigik to South Nacogdoches. Why didn't they fly him to Dillingham?
That was the hospital, and he had a heart attack. And
arrived up in the flatbed, remember?
Yeah. So a lot of the area knew that there was
a hospital
and a doctor, so anytime somebody had something tragic happen, car wreck or motorcycle wreck or heart attack or
my broken collarbone,
whatever it was, they just load them up in a plane or whatever, or ship them on
Sammy
a boat.
Sammy and Liam's grandma was no born ambulances in back then, so. The hospital there. Helvie's had her baby there. Her first daughter was there, born there.
So that was part of the reason why it's really significant, is that it brought resources to the not only the village of South Nacogdoches, but the area, the community.
Remember the nurses? They used to have nurses.
Yeah.
Doctor's room and then a nurse. And I remember the nurse would take care of me, then the doctor would come in.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a real
hospital.
It's a real clinic.
They're pretty cool.
Yeah. I remember the beds. Used to have those little white beds. I was wondering, why does this thing have this thing up, this four leg, you know? They had that, and they were like, I don't know what happened to all those beds.
Traction and all that. It was kind of cool. Even Bumblebee had
even
one.
The surgery table had a light above it.
Yeah.
Yep. Those were like, too bad they couldn't go back and just watch everything.
Yeah, I remember going in there, like, for my broken arm and stuff. There was a fisherman that was in there that had fish poisoning from, you know, from out in the bay. He had a cut or something and some fish grid gun and thing, so he was up there being seen for that. It was an Italian guy, and he had his hand underneath this red lamp, or this infrared lamp, and that was the cure for it, I guess.
Do you remember when the nurse passed? Well, I remember them taking her out in a body bag.
No, I knew that she'd passed away. I guess it wasn't there.
You were probably working. You're probably stocking shelves.
Yeah, you never know.
Yeah. So your first job, even though you weren't paid, was stocking shelves in the store.
Mm-hmm.
Then in high school, about 17 years old, you joined the beach gang.
Yep. So it's pretty much my whole life.
Then what's your next job?
My next job?
He got married when he's 20.
Being husband.
Yeah.
How old were you when you became Winter Watch?
I guess I don't know. It was 2000.
2001.
2001.
So I even got married then.
Oh, I never really paid attention to how old I was, but I was always.
Oh, so yes, yeah. But it's pretty. It's more recent.
Yeah.
More recent.
Yeah, 2001.
Okay.
2018 now, so 17.
Well,
years
it was
ago.
A decision because, you know, when my father passed away, my brother always lived with my father, and he's a little bit retarded. And he had to have a power of attorney. So it would depress him to move. So we decided to take the job just because he was there. And we had kids in college, and it was just building
up. We had options to move away and do other things, but we decided to stay there. I mean, it was part of our life already, but there was other things that kept us there. So.
Right, so taking on that additional responsibility of caretaking for the entire cannery 12 months out of the year instead of just doing the startup fishing and then closing up the cannery, you decided to take on that additional responsibility.
It was an add-on that kept us there, I guess, and we continued to work like we do now pretty much all year round.
You know, when I restored the whole house, I told him I'm not going to move there unless we restore it. And when I restored it, I found so many names in that house.
Written on walls and stuff.
Commissioner Regan's children's writings is on the wall. They grew up there. So it's probably 1930s.
Yeah.
And Carville Sr.'s writing and Sonia's writing and Clyde's writing and his kids. You just see so much of names in there
the history of the place.
So I'm making the kids write their names in the basement wall because I want, you know, we got to put our name there too.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Have we gotten pictures of those names when we've been over there?
Nope.
Maybe we can remember. That would be really nice to make sure.
Maybe the next time we go.
And Bill Smith was there, Daniel's dad. He grew up with the boys. And his name was on the wall. Like, wow.
Danny and William's grandpa.
It was under some real thick. Yeah. Old-fashioned wallpaper upstairs in your old bedroom. Like, holy cow, these are some cool names. I'm like, holy cow.
Yeah, there's a lot of history, a lot of tie into that cannery specifically.
Yeah.
And legacies that families that lived there.
Yeah, I mean, can you tell me anything about where does that come from? That people, because it's kind of a tradition, you know, to leave your mark somewhere.
That's why we're leaving our mark in the basement, because you could just see it. Even Samantha wrote her name. I was here.
Yeah. I don't know.
Is it just human nature, or do canneries inspire it?
I don't know.
I know I was changing Jess's bed back there, and I moved the boards, you know, the old boards, and Janice Hodgson wrote her name on a board. You know, she's passed away. I'm like, this is cool, you know. She's under the bed writing her name. It's like, wow. You know, so you have a lot of memories in that house.
Mm-hmm.
And then we redone the ceiling. You could tell where the old wood stove was. It was like, wow, can you imagine an old wood stove? In the living room, remember? It had a fire, remember? Yeah. It was a fire on
it. We pulled some of the ceiling tile down and we discovered that the house had been in the fire before.
Stovepipe.
We found that burnt stuff on the ceiling and
probably wood stove.
So we had to do some research to figure out if there was a fire and, you know, how the house was occupied before and why.
We have a picture of the house with the old bicycle car. What's it called? The fancy car that's down by the lead shop. The old guts of it.
Hmm.
I have a picture of it, our house, in that day to now, and I'm having it put together. It was black and white and then ours, yeah. Yeah, history there.
So what additional responsibilities came with becoming the Winter Watchman?
Additional? Oh, well, I ended up becoming the supervisor during the summertime. And there was a lot of additional responsibilities to that. But as far as the Winter Watchman's job, it's been the same pretty much every year. You make sure that everybody that you are able to watch all of the buildings and make sure nobody breaks into anything, or, you know, you track down and figure out who did it, or you're always making sure that nobody steals anything. Or
to me, nowadays, you really need a watchman because Bumblebee has been broken into.
Well, Bumblebee's abandoned.
Really
and they don't
bad.
Have, they don't have anybody there. So,
and if no one was at South Naknek Diamond End Cannery, it would probably be people in there too.
Yeah. And not necessarily locals. I don't blame a whole lot of locals at all. I know that it's
the skiffs.
It's the boats and the skiffs during the summertime that people come up there for 2-3 weeks and they just want to go exploring in their time off.
Because he saw mud tracks going up and then going back. So it's the skiffs.
Yeah, that's it's a It's one of the big responsibilities of Winter Watchmen to make sure that everything stays intact for the company.
Now, I live there and I know this place, so I think it's interesting, though, for those who don't have that experience out there, that part of the reason that it is so important to have a family like you guys there is because the electricity is actually shut down for a majority of these buildings. So we think about like modern security and surveillance, it's not really feasible because of the size of these places, the number of nooks and crannies that all need to be monitored.
Mm-hmm. No, there's no
way. So it comes down to a family like you guys having that presence, having that knowledge. And then, in my opinion, it's having those relationships.
Yep.
And so if you can take
Know that as a Winter Watchman, I'm always aware of what everybody's doing. Not necessarily to be nosy, but I got to know who has tendencies to do what. And if something happens, you can pretty much figure out who did it just because of my knowledge of everybody in town, or whether a boat or a skiff came by, or if somebody new in town, or somebody else doing something else somewhere else, and
remember
all of a sudden
the year
they have time to
when
break
the
something.
Power went out for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Thank God the cannery was there because no one had nowhere to go. So Clyde hooked up the generator and was cooking for the whole village.
Because
and Josie's husband and my dad were on oxygen. Thank God the generators were working for 2 weeks.
That was in 2013.
Can't remember.
And they had to restring the power line.
Yeah.
Right? My dad flew the
helicopter to
the helicopter over. I mean, that was
the poles snapped like toothpicks.
Yeah.
At the river crossing, and I tell you, I was on the north side, but looking just driving down the road and not seeing the lights of South Naknek was the spookiest thing in the whole world.
We were without power for 2 weeks after.
Clyde was living there then. It wasn't 2013. We were there 2001. So it was before Clyde. So he hooked up the generator and was cooking. So he had all that food from the cannery. So
the cannery has its own generator power. And that's why he was able to turn power on at the cannery. He ran his own cannery generator and it lit up the whole plant.
And
versus South Naknek, which it only had power to NEA.
Because nobody was ready. Like this earthquake, nobody was ready. So at least Clyde had water and food and heat, especially for the elders.
So, I mean, I know we've talked about it four or five different ways, but there really is this responsibility back and forth of the community caring for the cannery, but the cannery also
cares for the community.
Cares for the community. Mm-hmm.
And it was the only fuel. It was the only fuel that we had. Nowadays, it's run by the council, but back then it was cannery was selling the fuel to the village, oil and gas.
So, yeah, I mean they always take a part of whatever has to happen in South Naknek. Usually goes through the cannery, and so like I said, like she was saying, the only place in town was to buy gas or oil or diesel was at our plant, and so that was one of the things as Winter Watchman. I was a fuel salesman also.
We also made the gym and the library as one of the spots to go to in case, or the cannery,
and that's just up the hill from the cannery.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all pretty close,
because I've been handing out things.
It all goes hand in hand, I think. Like you said, the resources that the cannery has is important to the community, and the community is important to the cannery also, for the amount of people at work.
What do you think the most important role of the cannery is in the community?
Employment. Processing fish, making sure that the company stays viable and selling their product so that they can make money to keep on employing people. So it's all together.
Anything else you would like to share?
No, I think we're pretty much covered it. I we've got a lot of different things happening all the time. It seems like every year is different. Nowadays, I do a lot of supervisory role, but they also ask me to run tenders and run boats, and I run skiffs, and we do whatever we have to get the job done for the company, because I mean we have to make money for the company too in order for me to stay employed. So it's just all part of it, I guess, that we do whatever we have to. And we do have a lot of resourceful people that work for our company that either work during the summertime or just all year long. You know, my cousin Walter Hodgson, he does a great job of filling in for me when I'm gone, and his wife is their grandmother, and she does a great job in the summertime.
She took
cooking.
Over my job.
She's down there in the mess hall cooking.
I recommended her, and she took over
laundry and then our mess hall. So it's just all one big.
I used to cook for spring and fall. It was fun. Ryan and Ramey thought they were going to be the bakers growing up. Yeah.
Well, and you said a lot of resourceful people work there. I know what that means, but I know a lot of the people that read this interview later or listen to it later aren't necessarily going to know what that means. Can you explain that?
In what way, I guess? What are you looking for?
What is our Bristol Bay resourcefulness? What makes you that resourceful person that's that key team member that you want to work shoulder to shoulder with?
Well, I don't really have a solid answer for that. I think everybody that lives in South Naknek
watches out for each other. And
no, it's everybody knows how to accomplish whatever it takes, because you can't just go down the street and find a professional. You're a jack of all trades. You're a handyman. You're able to do carpentry work. You can do welding. You can do machine work. You can work on cars. You can work on boats. You can work on airplanes. Everybody has a lot of talent in a lot of different fields, whereas I guess a lot of the people in the city only have professional jobs and doing one thing most of their lives. They're really good at it, but can they do all of those things? And you grew up with all my brothers, sisters, cousins, friends that were able to share their knowledge in different fields and whatever it took to try to help out, to try to fix the problem at hand. You were able to do it, or had to do it, actually. You had no other choice. You had no other resource. So a lot of the resource is right within each person. So I would say that.
Yeah, it's pretty important, and to me it's one of the more unique things about living in Bush, Alaska, mm-hmm. is that you do have to be a master of a lot of different little skills.
Yeah.
Sammy, what do you think of the NNN project and where Grandma and Grandpa live at?
Reaches my satisfaction. I find it enjoying. Well, my enjoyment. Where it's the stories you can tell.
And when you guys are all grown up and we're really old and you guys are the ones that take over, you're going to know how to work on a car. You're going to know how to fix a door or a window. You're not going to know how to do insulation. You're going to know how to all the things that I do right now, even though you guys don't know it now. You're going to have to.
Yes.
So,
yep. There it is. That's it.
Do you have a favorite story you can share about the cannery, Sam?
Going to the mess hall.
Growing up in the buildings, a lot of the big buildings are empty when everybody's gone, and you're able to run around a big warehouse or big mess hall or solid floors or going to Diamond O, all kinds of
fun. One of my favorite things. I remember walking there, and when I was walking down the road with Grandma and you, you're with that big revolver.
Oh yeah, my big gun.
that big one.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of bears out.
Yeah.
And a fox walked by. I was amazed by it. And stopped thinking about it. Then saw bears a lot. Still these. I never went to Slethnacnik without seeing a bear. Mm-hmm. At the dump or anywhere.
Well, the wildlife we have over there.
You
all
around you.
Bears, foxes,
Sammy's eagles, parents. Sammy's parents
fish.
Own this A-frame, and they're trying to find property to put it on. And Sammy's wishes is to what, Sammy? He wants to put it right at the cannery and live in the cannery because he likes the cannery.
Right next there.
Yep, right next door.
Mm-hmm. At the end of the season, when I was probably about your age, Teal Smith would get done fishing and be in town before he headed back to Dillingham, and every year we would have a field trip, and we would start at about Peter Pan and go all the way down to Red Salmon and creep through all the canneries. You also had to dodge the winter watchmen. So
yes.
We didn't break anything, yeah. But it was just,
which
those
guys that break stuff that
it's
I
It's the ones that break stuff, yeah. Yeah, but it was a big deal to be able to sneak into the box loft or something, or find that,
we used to,
you know,
play hide and go seek,
where all the
remember?
Wooden box parts were.
It's
left
adventuresome.
Over from, it is an adventure.
We would play hide and go seek. Mm-hmm.
And if my mother knew about it with all those bears under the docks, she would have a cow. So hopefully my mom's not listening to this right now.
I know. We've all been there.
Yeah.
Not supposed to go to the cannery.
No. Yeah, but we did.
But we did anyway.
We did anyway. We did anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I have some photos here. Would you like to, I can put all these on a thumb drive for you, but if you want to click through any of these, if you see something
a lot
worth
of them
talking about, tell me what building it is. And we'll talk about it.
That looks like PAF or somewhere else.
Yeah, that's not us.
Is that somewhere else?
Because look at this, honey.
Yeah, that's
the tower. That's not
okay. So we're looking at the water towers with the PAF in the background. And there's a big warehouse-style building with some 55-gallon drums in front. And so this is not... Yeah, this is record number 434 of the Pacific Northwest Studies collection. So that one is not at NN.
That is at NN.
That's
Foreman Shack.
Foreman Shack.
Mm-hmm. That blue building.
Yep. Yeah.
There,
and there's a mess all over here.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
435 is Foreman Shack. Diamond NN. Yep, Diamond NN. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
This is the Provisions Warehouse. It's Bunkhouse 5. Bunkhouse 4, Bunkhouse 3, Bunkhouse 2, Bunkhouse 1,
okay.
And Filipino mess.
And the laundry. Look at the laundry.
So this is taken from up around the ways,
right? By
coming
the,
down.
Here's
Chinese. Place. Yeah, right by the Chinese graveyard.
Hospital.
To the left.
Yep.
Hospital.
Here's a hospital right there. Yeah.
Here's the laundry, Sammy.
Well, is there anything you can tell me about the Chinese bunkhouses?
They're not in the picture. But
not
the
in
Chinese,
the picture.
From where this picture is taken, though?
No, this is not the Chinese bunkhouses. This is Chinese
this is
graveyard.
An S hall.
Okay.
Yeah, so the
they're over here.
Yeah, they're actually
they're
over
actually right here.
Yeah. They're not
they're
in, the
in the picture.
So it's just down the road from the mess hall, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know the swing is upstairs, the provisions? We walk upstairs and there's that big swing. That's where it is, Sammy.
Mm-hmm. Now the can you tell me why the Filipino mess hall has that name?
The Filipino mess hall was a Chinese mess hall before, when they had segregation to keep most of the people that ate a certain type of food continue on that diet. And then they had the other mess hall for everybody else.
They had
that, mostly Italians
food.
And Sicilians, but that's what I remember. The big the stories that I used to hear about Chinese mess hall was the great big woks that they used to cook in. And then the Filipino mess hall had their own style of food for the Filipinos, who were the traditional fish cutters at the time.
Look, three tanks, dear.
Okay.
OK. Okay.
Did you ever eat at the Filipino mess hall?
Yeah. That yeah. was that was very tasty.
Not me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was getting a pot.
What we were when we were so small, we had to bring pots down at 12:30 or 5:30. 12 o'clock was lunchtime, and 5 o'clock was dinner time usually. And within a half an hour to 45 minutes after everybody ate and started to leave, there was a lot of leftovers. So they were able to give the locals instead of throwing it away to the garbage dump, they would give it the leftover food away. It was always very hot and very good and very tasty, and that was wonderful to have.
Look,
I was
no always trees.
Looking forward to getting the bringing the pot down, and they'd fill it up with all the different food groups, and we'd take it home.
And so that would probably happen more than once a day.
Yeah, well, twice a day for me. Surely too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So
there's a lighthouse.
Yeah. There's my grandpa's house. Grandpa Nick built that house, and Grandma Mary, and my dad grew up.
And there's
in that
your
house.
Other one he built.
Is yeah. that one still there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is still there.
Okay, we're looking at it. It's on the left here in image number 443. And this is still taken
yes.
from the Chinese mm-hmm. Graveyard location, correct?
Yeah.
And you said this is the lead house?
This one is lead house.
Can you tell me about the lead house?
That's where they would make the leads. If you go there now, it's got pieces of lead in there. You know, the little leads.
For the nets.
For the nets.
Yeah.
Those are the weights for the mm-hmm. fishing nets. So were they casting them there and putting them on the ropes?
Yep.
Is there any of that casting equipment?
I think
or
all the.
Hanging around?
I think it's just a few pieces of
just
lead.
Just a few pieces of lead around, yeah. huh?
Mm-hmm.
They'd have their own blacksmith shop and all that kind of stuff too. So you'll probably see it in the pictures.
Look at the house we lived in.
What color were these?
Gray.
Do you remember?
It's
this
gray.
Was this is
it's
gray.
Gray
with the red
so
roof.
All the bunk houses and things
gray.
When you guys were growing up were gray.
Gray with red roof.
Mm-hmm.
Gray with red roofs. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's part of what we're going to try to recreate in this model is some of the paint colors. So there's another yellow color.
Yep,
not much
one.
Brush. That's still our provisions warehouse.
Yep. Mess hall.
Mess hall. Filipino mess hall.
Number 4.
Uh-huh. That must be... It's down on the, not the carpenter shop is behind,
this is the pig pen.
Is that the pig pen?
Yeah, look from the pig pen looking down the aisle.
Oh yeah.
Provisions warehouse is that.
Now, pig pen reminds me, can you tell me anything about animals at the cannery?
I don't remember
well,
any.
Pig pen was nicknamed that because that's where they kept a lot of the old discarded machinery. So it had nothing to do with animals. So, they did have animals, livestock that they brought up in the springtime that were slaughtered and cooked on camp in the mess halls. But that had nothing to do with the pig pen.
Mm.
Pig pen was just a place where they had a junkyard for discarded equipment.
Old metal pieces.
Mm-hmm. But you know, there's no mess hall. There's the freezer.
You just can't see it though. It's there.
But I know you've told me you have a hutch made out of turkey boxes.
Yeah, well, live
Grandma,
turkeys
Grandma
were
Mary's.
Live turkeys were brought in also as part of this. Those turkey boxes kept live turkeys, and then they were slaughtered there and then cooked. So some of the boxes were reused again, if you will. Because there wasn't a whole lot of lumber stores around, people, whenever they discarded anything back in that day, was a lot of the wood was reused, or in this case, it was reused for a hutch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's partly because there's not a lot of large trees and things like that in our area, so...
There's no trees that you can harvest for anything of the use. Everything had to be brought in the springtime.
Can you talk about any of the other boxes that people reuse all the time?
They do a lot of... a lot of the salmon boxes were reused. Kerosene boxes for sleds. Gosh, just about anything that you brought up. It was made out of wood, and a lot of it was made out of wood, was repurposed.
I took a picture of the one at Semenoski Church. It was made out of some box.
Yeah.
I thought, wow, that's pretty cool.
Some people build houses out of it.
It said something soda on it.
Mm-hmm. I've seen pictures that John Branson has used in his presentations.
John Branson and I are
shingling a whole roof
with gas cans. We compare notes all the time.
Yeah, I could see you guys having a great conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's you can see that when you walk through the bunkhouses, all of the makeshift furniture and things like that cannery workers have been making and using over the years.
Mm-hmm. The stools,
yes.
Or spools, I mean.
Spools,
yeah.
But they double as a nightstand, they're furniture, but really they...
Boxes.
Boxes turned on end and fastened to the wall in different ways. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a pretty creative way to get comfortable.
Well, that's the ways, dear.
Yeah.
So the ways are located on the back side
of the Chinese
cannery.
Look at the graveyard.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And that fence is no longer there, is it?
Mm-mm.
We're looking at photo number 460.
It's overgrown with bushes.
A big pile of wood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think your grandpa has a picture of that boat.
Chicken coop.
That's the chicken coop.
Okay, so this is right next to the White House, correct?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So here's a goofy question. Were there actually chickens in the chicken
coop? I imagine
coop?
So.
I don't know. We probably. I don't know. Yeah.
I imagine so.
Probably.
Yeah, that's probably where it came from.
Just the way it's built inside.
That's what they call it. It's a chicken coop. And they turned it into housing. So, I don't know.
So who do you remember staying
there? Ask your mom.
Yeah.
So we have to ask Annie.
She would. You need every interview here.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm gonna write her down. We can do that this next year.
That's the house we live in now. It's a winter house.
Oh my gosh! That's the garage.
Mm-hmm. And this is the garage.
Sure, it has two doors.
This is a big cat garage.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh.
Look at all the mud.
There's that
there's
thing.
There's a cat right there.
You repaired that.
Okay, so this is image number 468. So this must have been taken sometime in the spring, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no grass, and that is a muddy disaster.
Mm-hmm.
This house right here, it used to be their old garage,
mm-hmm.
but... It got broken down, then they're starting to use this one.
Mm-hmm.
So this one is, the one on the building on the left that we can just see the edge of is no longer there?
It's still there, but it's just the front of it broke down.
Look at your bedroom.
Yeah, and that's where my bedroom is right there. It used to be...
Grandpa Junior's?
Junior's.
Yeah.
That used to be his room, and...
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
On the door it says danger to keep the girls out.
Yes.
Oh, that's funny.
And it's actually still on the door.
Yep. That's cool. I like the doors.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Is that right next to the
house? That's my greenhouse.
Is that your greenhouse?
That's my greenhouse.
That's the crow's nest.
Okay.
That's my greenhouse. He moved it there.
So tell me about the crow's nest.
That's a place where they kept a lot of this, like the head of the pork chop and the carpenter boss and that kind of, the head supervisory people would stay there.
Look at the laundry clothesline. Here's the laundry.
Mm-hmm.
I remember those clotheslines. A lot of wool blankets on there. Wow, they moved it.
So this is photo number 472. So this had to have been personal clothing because the laundry would have been using the big dryers,
mm-hmm.
right?
But Plus
well, no, the laundry also used it.
Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we all had a sheet changing day, and then Sunday we'd wash to Gary Johnson's, or we'd wash this person's, and we always personally washed our clothes.
They used both dryers and the clotheslines. Depending on, I mean, not for the whole crew. I imagine just for side jobs and stuff.
Because Sunday would be the White House, and then Mondays would be number 5, and Tuesday would be number 3, and every day was a thing for each bunkhouse.
So cannery workers would bundle up all of their linens, and they'd come drop it off, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember when I worked for Sue Asplin down by Peterson Point, watching her kids down at the cabin, we'd take our laundry every week to the cannery, and I just remember these big bags with the huge safety pins going through.
They do,
You didn't take anything that was at risk of shrinking, because I think they washed it at about 1,000 degrees.
Steam.
I remember seeing some of the fishermen use those clotheslines as antennas, so they can listen to the radios in their country, like Croatia and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Come. You're in the hot seat. Okay, we've got a joiner. Family reunion is beginning. Can you introduce yourself for us?
Sam
Stewart.
That's me.
Okay, tell us about the antennas.
Well, they would use those clotheslines. They were made out of wire. And so they clip these little radios, these handheld radios that they had, so they can listen to their local stations, like over in Croatia and Europe and stuff. It's pretty neat to see.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I go there and I'm like, what are you guys doing? Because they're just sitting in the grass. You know?
How old were you? When do you think this happened?
I was probably 13 or 14.
So that would have been in the
93, 94.
Wow. Were you working there?
Under the table for Gary Johnson.
Since you guys all started working when you were 7 years old, unofficially.
Yeah.
Who approved this? Wow. Wow. So, on the radio communications, I think we do need to talk about that. Part of the house, you guys have the radio room.
Well, what part of our house was actually the wireless room, they called it. And that's where they had a professional electronics person. And he would monitor all the radios and the transaction between the canneries and the tenders and the transactions between our cannery and a different cannery, say in a different area. So he did a lot of the radio. That's why they called him a radio man. He'd work on the radios. He'd know how to plug in different devices in their radios and fix them and stuff. So
he had a cool radio room.
Mm-hmm. He'd have all his wares too. He'd have shelves and shelves of diodes and crystals and all kinds of that, whatever they used back then. And he'd be able to repair just about anything.
Yeah, because for some of these long distance communications, that would have to be an old shortwave.
Shortwave, yeah. Ham radio, all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Because nowadays, the watchman answer the radios at night, and you answer them during the day.
Yeah.
See, they're still on the radio.
Well, and just us living in our rural village, I mean, cell phones have changed everything, but, I mean, radios were it. I mean, did you have a call sign on the radio?
I did not.
You didn't?
Junior did.
Junior, you did. Well, I guess my dad's a pilot, so I got...
Mm-hmm.
I had a call sign from the time I was little, so, yeah. Because we had radios all over the place, but it was an important way of communicating.
Mm-hmm.
I think it still is. Cell phones aren't totally reliable out there yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is that just another view of the...
That's between the bunkhouse 3 and 2.
That's the bed frame.
Yeah.
It's but falling they over.
They did it for some... I don't know what it was before.
They moved it.
No, it fell down. It blew apart.
Okay, so this one's kind of just in skeletal remains.
Oh, where Martin and Laurie lived.
I don't know.
Martin and Laurie lived in there when they first...
So we're looking at photo
number... There's number 2 bunkhouse right here.
Yeah.
Okay. Number 4.
We're looking at image number 476. So this little shack that we see here is not really standing anymore.
Nope, the blue part.
There's the provisions right there.
Okay.
There'll be a trail going down. My greenhouse.
Yeah.
Greenhouse again. We're looking at image still number 480. Like
wow, which the wall looked like that. And you know, our yard, our driveway, boards are coming up like planks. So it had to be a boardwalk right in front of the garage.
Oh, in front of the garage at your house. So that's kind of...
There's a big board
right... dirt over it now, but there used to be a boardwalk.
Looks like there's a board coming up this long. I told you I didn't need to move it. It's going to pop up. Wow. That's the second garage.
Second garage.
There's a hotel. Look, no trees.
Mm-mm, this is
no trespassing.
Image number 484.
That's
store.
Store. Mm-hmm. Okay, so right here from the bottom left, because this is the back side.
Well, is it?
Right? No. Is it? Or is this the front side?
I don't know, it might be a different building.
No, that's the hill.
I don't recognize this fence there. No, it still is. That's the store.
Because here's going down, yeah, and here's...
It must have been a different thing before they made it a store.
June, here's the married quarters.
Yeah, it is. And there's the front of the dock down there. The hotel will be right up here.
Yeah, and that addition where the door is, it's not there right there.
Yeah, that might have been a warehouse for some other reason.
They may have converted it.
Okay, so we're looking at image number 488.
Rec Hall.
When did it become used for the rec hall upstairs?
After the store closed. Gary Johnson probably was part of that. They quit the company store during the wintertime.
They put the little company store back here, remember?
Yeah.
And then we'd have to walk through.
So the store got smaller.
Yeah, it got smaller and then it went away.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think drove, what drove that store becoming smaller?
I don't know. Just changing times.
Then they completely no more store.
Sears catalog.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
more people shopped at Nacton Trading than ours or something.
Yeah. So resources probably became available in another way. So that conveyor belt runs from this back left corner up. Upstairs. And that's where you bring your boxes of heavy peaches and things up.
Mm-hmm. Winch house. Mm-hmm. That's still standing.
Okay. So this is the winch house that would have housed the winch. For the boatways.
To pull the boats up.
Right by the stockroom, down.
Okay, so this is image number 496.
Still standing.
What color?
Red.
It was red. Mm-hmm. Just a standard APA.
They call it Diamond O Red.
No, APA Red.
APA red, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's ways. Mm-hmm. We have Grepenick's pictures, and he has that. I have pictures of him working on this ways.
Those are tugboats.
Mm-hmm.
So this was part of your job with spring fall crew.
Not this one.
No. Was to pull those boats? No.
No, it was the same thing at Diamond O. We did barges and tenders. This set of ways was at NN Cannery, and they pulled up tugboats and flat scows. Pretty much the same thing, just different era.
Okay, mm-hmm. So this wasn't in use during your...
No, mm-hmm. this had fallen Pre-dates. In and nobody
Not even
nobody
your dad's time, I don't think.
No,
wow.
Grandpa Nick's time.
Yeah,
Grandpa Because I have time. Grandpa Nick with that boat.
So that had to have been some pretty old technology that was powering that winch.
1930, because Grandpa Nick's pictures.
The technology to run the steam winch had changed over the years. It started out as crude oil burners, Bunker C, and that drove a steam tank that provided steam to a railroad engine, like where you had two pistons go choo 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 choo, and that's what drove the winch to pull the cable, and then on top of the cable was a cradle, and these boats would sit on the cradle and they'd get
You could see two cables.
There's four, or actually three. Four parts. Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4.
So oh, yeah, four.
It'd block and tackle type for cables so you can get more pull.
Okay, and this is image number 500.
What costs five?
Well, look good. They're building right here.
Yeah, they're probably building something there.
Yep, because the
provisions not there yet.
Provisions isn't. Yeah, this is all open.
Yeah.
There's the ice house.
Is that that's not there anymore? Is it?
It's still there.
Still is there.
It? It's ready to fall over.
Oh, okay.
But it was an insulated house that one of the jobs my grandpa Nick had was as a winter watchman, and it might even be him. But that's kind of the job that they had was they had a man-made pond that would hold water, and then they would cut ice chunks out of that during the winter, and then they'd haul it into the ice house before spring, fill this all the way up to the top, and it was insulated so it would last all summer. And that was your refrigeration for the summer.
Okay, so we're looking at image number 504. So behind where the current provisions warehouse was, there was a pond.
Yeah.
Nope.
And
yeah, yes.
It's kind of in the back.
Yes, it was a man-made pond. It was
man-made
a,
pond.
A dam, they called it.
And so but a dam of what?
Water.
And of water, of the little creek that comes
yeah,
through?
There's a creek over here, through. And then they made it mm-hmm. over here. Yeah.
Can you tell us the name of the creek?
Alaska Packers Creek.
Yeah, that's what I remember is Packers Creek, right? Mm-hmm. That's what everybody pretty much calls it. So so they take that cut those frozen ice chunks out
mm-hmm.
and carry them over and put them in.
And stack them in the ice house.
In that little ice house. And this is conveniently located mm-hmm. to the mess hall. You're pretty much just right there.
Yeah, you brought the ice in, ice house, and then you just put it over to the mess hall.
Just a quick jaunt over.
Mm-hmm. Well, mess hall, but other buildings, you know, the White House had those, what do you call those, refrigeration house?
They do. It's still there.
It's the old
ice box.
Ice box. They call them ice boxes.
It's mm-hmm. still there.
Well, they take chunks of ice out of there and put them in the ice box in the winter house, or in the White House, so that they have refrigeration. They can store food in there, keep it chilled.
So all this ice would have had to have been gathered early enough in the year?
Oh, yeah. It was a big job to be able to do all that, and they usually had three wintermen to each plant. Grandpa was one of three different wintermen that lived there. One in the house that we're at, the house that Grandpa was in, and then the one up on top where Brad lives in now mm-hmm. Was a winter house also. So they had three different families that had to live there because they had so many different things to do during the winter before everybody came up in the spring.
Before we could all hit switches and have everything just be powered and function, it took three families to keep this place going.
Yep. And it was all year long.
Wow.
Sam, your bunkhouse.
Oh, I forgot to zoom in. We should make sure on our image number 504. Can you...
Oh, we don't know those guys.
Okay, I thought you said you might have recognized one.
No. Those are from the store.
Okay.
Italians use them a lot.
That looks like a native. That guy in the White House looks like native. Well, look at the boardwalk.
I know, it's so straight.
And look at the piping all on top.
Mm-hmm. So this is image number 508.
Number four.
Bunkhouse number four mm-hmm. from the backside.
That was a paint locker.
Mm-hmm.
Stored a lot of paint in there, probably for working on the ways and the different barges that they had to paint.
Behind the mess hall.
Right behind
This is right behind the mess hall, and Packers Creek is kind of running.
Packers Creek runs under here.
Underneath.
This is the paint locker. This is also the Chinese
bunkhouses. Look, there's no brush. You can see them. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're looking at image number 512. And they look like the Chinese bunkhouses are pretty intact and standing mm-hmm. up straight here.
Yeah.
There they are.
Wow. Fancy.
Yeah, they still have color on them.
Maybe the fire thing.
And these, they, do you think they were just being used as storage in this point?
No, they were probably bunkhouses.
Oh, this one has, steps.
Were they utilized as bunkhouses at all when you guys were kids?
No, they didn't have Chinese people there.
No, but nobody was, they were just probably storing nuts and bolts and things like that in them at that point.
Yeah, when we were there, but that image there is probably being used as a bunkhouse.
Mm-hmm. It's a bunkhouse.
Same thing. Chinese bunkhouse.
Look at all that wood.
Mm-hmm. Back when they were maintaining them, huh?
That's the blacksmith shop.
Oh, yeah, the blacksmith shop.
They had a blacksmith that was able to make anything, really, from iron.
Okay, so this is image number 524. So they would have been fabricating their own tools and parts?
Yep. Parts.
That's why they have that big stove thing in there.
Yeah, there was a big furnace in there. Heat. Probably wood fired or coal fired. Lumps of coal, I think, is what I remember.
And all of that coal would be...
would heat up whatever you had to make molten iron. You had forms and different things you had to make. Lead. You could make bearings for some of the machinery in there.
Provisions.
Mm-hmm. Now, Provisions Warehouse right now looks like a fisherman's net loft.
Mm-hmm. Up on top, the fishermen had lockers up there.
That's probably where they kept all the salt barrels that came off the boats.
I don't know. I think the people are starting to show up here.
Okay.
So.
Well, we can...
We can continue some other time if you want.
We can.
Send me this and I'll write them down.
Well, I was going to give you this whole thing on a thumb drive.
And we'll look at it.
Do you want it? And then you guys can make notes and you can do it at your own leisure.
And I'll send it to you.
Okay. Amazing. Thank you.
This is a lot.